I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Conrad Black joins me again. His most recent book, a collection of his writing, has just been published. Backward Glances, People and Events from Inside and Out, collects a number of his pieces on various subjects, pieces on politics, history, faith, and the law. There are columns he's written on Canada, how he sees its past and its future. There are pieces on America and the wider world, Europe and the Middle East. There are a lot of pieces that are witty, too. There's a lot in this book that's opinionated and thought-provoking, and where the writer has re-examined some positions, he acknowledges the evolving in his thinking. He is someone who has seen firsthand a lot of history, and in this book you read of that, of the personal connections he has had to events and the people of his times. It's a good time to check in with Conrad again, as it's not been 1 month since the American election that saw his friend Donald Trump elected the 45th President of the United States. The website for more is at conradmblack.com. The Twitter handle is at conradmblack. The book is published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plante on the Line program in Toronto today, Conrad Black. Lord Black, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, before we get to the book, a couple of current affairs things, if I may. The American election, you were criticized online a lot for your support of Donald Trump. What's it like now to see someone you know, a friend of yours, become the president?
Well, you know, I've known some other presidents of the U.S. before they were elected, not on a first-name basis like this, so it's not a completely novel experience, but President Reagan and both Presidents Bush I knew before they were elected president, but you know, it's interesting to know the holder of such an office, certainly, but as I said, the novelty of it isn't so great, but the fact that I knew them didn't mean that I saw a great deal of them while they were president, and I wouldn't necessarily expect to see a great deal of this president when he's installed either, but on a personal basis, he is, as I said before, he's not at all like the caricature of him. He's a very gracious, pleasant, companionable individual, and so I'm, you know, I'm glad for his success. Now, with that said, I modestly knew Mrs. Clinton too, so.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I should have mentioned Bill Clinton. I knew him as governor of Arkansas. We owned some newspapers in that state, and I was on a first name basis with him before he was president. So, as I say, it isn't such a novelty, but and it's not something that you would ever try to abuse or to turn into some kind of grandeur for myself. It's just my good fortune because of the business I was in to have met a lot of these people. But I think it will be a very interesting term as president.
Yeah. So you referred in a recent column to Donald Trump's verbal infelicities. I'm assuming, if you were advising him at all, you'd perhaps get him to curb some of that. What else would you advise him if you were asked?
Well, you know, I would be hesitant to give him too much advice because. He's essentially been advising himself, and he is now the president-elect. Not many people, including in the early stages, I myself thought he would get there. I took his campaign at the beginning more seriously than most people, and once I saw the numbers he was pulling in certain states, I thought his chances of winning were good and progressively better. But with him, you never know how much is tactical. He gives the appearance of being unable to control himself and restrain himself from saying things that are judged to be inopportune, and certainly it's an absurd comparison. But if I were in any such position, I wouldn't say such things. But there is some method to it, and he has accurately judged that he seems to attract more votes than he repels by some of these controversial statements he's made. But I think in general he is doing what we would all advise him to do anyway, which is now that he's won the election, just get on with preparing to govern. And at this point, action speaks a lot louder than words. I think he's putting in good people, clearly chosen to enact the reform program that he's promised, and he has said that he will call a special session of Congress and try and put his whole program through in 100 days, as Roosevelt did. And he has the votes in the Congress, and he has the mandate from the country. So I think he's going to do it. And I don't think he needs much advice from me or anyone else on how to do it.
By the way, have you talked to him since November the 8th?
I have not spoken with him. Mm-hmm. I've had a written message and an extensive message from a senior member of the staff, but pleasantries only, and I have not spoken with him.
By the way, another thing that I wondered about throughout the campaign was whether he, because some people wondered if he was patriotic at all, but, you know him a lot better than most. Does he have a sense of history, and like, does he know, like, do you think he's read a lot about American presidents?
A significant amount. He did me the courtesy of reading my books on Roosevelt and Nixon. And mm-hmm. I had the impression that he'd read a fair number of others. I think he's not a first-rate historian and wouldn't hold himself out to be one, but he's I think quite familiar with the careers of the more prominent presidents. I don't think his knowledge of international history is particularly well developed, but I think he has a pretty fair grasp of American history.
Now, another issue that
he's a well-educated
sure.
man, you know,
yeah, yeah.
And he had a good academic career.
Yeah. What's happening in this country? The story in the news the last couple of weeks have been these bonuses that post-media executives have been receiving. You're someone who founded the National Post. You write for it. What do you make of how the paper is today as opposed to when you owned it?
Well, there have been difficult times for the industry, and you have to make allowance for that. But I have made it clear that I did not think that the course the management has been on for some years has been the correct one. And, I don't want to carp from the sidelines. I've said that at a quarterly teleconference of shareholders, and I wrote it in a piece in the National Post, and I don't want to keep, beating that drum, but I think part of the problem are management errors, and I think there's some room to be critical of the compensation levels, but, as I say, I don't want to make an issue out of it. And I think there's some overuse of the fact that the industry has been under pressure generally. It's used as an excuse for unnecessarily poor performance, I would say. I mean, the fact is there are methods of getting newspapers through, protecting their franchise and being much more buoyant financially than what has happened at that company. But, I'm not part of the management anymore, so, my opinion's not worth any more than anyone else's is.
Would you want to own a newspaper again?
No. No. I didn't like employing journalists, and it's not a good business anymore. I'm perfectly happy getting my own opinions out and getting them out to a very wide readership in the U.S. and Canada and Britain, and not having to deal with a management structure based on such a temperamental group as journalists tend to be.
So, to your book, Backward Glances, which I was telling you just as we started, I enjoyed. Are you by nature, Conrad, a nostalgic person?
Yes, to a degree. I wouldn't have thought to excess, so it's a comparative thing. I'm certainly, yeah, to some extent, Joe, I am. Yes, I guess so. But I would hope not to an extent that's maudlin or mawkish or anything like that.
Yeah, you know,
I don't
yeah.
dwell on the past obsessively or anything, but, yeah. but uh, you I always respect the past. You learn from it, whether it's your own experiences or studying the history of others.
Yeah, because I was wondering, as you were putting this book together, what it was like to reread yourself.
Some things were quite evocative, you know. Depends on the subject. I mean, some reflections on earlier times and my brother and others. And if you notice, it's dedicated to a number of people, and all good friends, and a number of them are dead now, and some of them have been dead for some time. But there certainly is a raking over of memories, most of them pleasant in that case, but it reminded me of how many years have gone by. I feel physically pretty much the same as I did 30 years ago, but I'm in fact not getting any younger.
So did you find yourself, as you were reading some of the pieces, some of the older ones, revising your thoughts or opinions on various subjects? I mean, do you find yourself doing that at all, revising an opinion?
A little bit, sometimes, yes. I have to say, I hope it doesn't sound too self-serving, that at least as often, I rather was impressed with the fact that my views, which might not have been widely held at the time, proved to be accurate. But, as you know, being in the field yourself, you call it as you see it, and sometimes you're right and sometimes not. But I thought my record, I didn't choose the columns or essays that held me in the worst light. But one does not do that. But even allowing for that, I felt that my record was quite defensible, and certainly not perfect, but quite defensible.
Now, as a writer, as a stylist, did you think over the years you have improved? I mean, does it get easier for you to write?
Yeah, I can write fairly quickly, and I think it has. I think I was wordier earlier on, inadequately economic words. Though I was an admirer of writers like Orwell and Camus and so on, I hadn't really focused on trying to avoid unnecessary words the way they did. And some would probably find me still a little florid, but not like I used to be. So I think I have improved. I think it's like most things, the more you do it, the better you get at it, you know.
And you mentioned that you write quickly. Do you show your work to other people before it gets to an editor? Say, I know you're married to a writer who's rather good. Do you share?
She's very good. And not normally, no. I write it, read it once, and send it in. Normally, no one changes anything. Or if they do, they suggest a word here or a comma there or something. That's all. Yeah. My stuff is not heavily edited, and it goes in pretty much as I write it.
Yeah. Growing up, was it important for you to not only study history, but say get close to it? Because I'm reading some of the pieces, and you get a sense of how interested you were in the events of time and the people involved. You got to know a lot of these personalities on a personal basis. Was that something that you wanted to do, say, as a kid?
Yes. I always had a sense that everybody I knew, or virtually everybody I knew, would comment on public figures, and they really didn't know them, and they didn't really know much about them. They might know something about current events, but I from early on, I thought that, even as an adolescent, I thought that a great many people commenting on public personalities and public events were essentially blowhards. They didn't know anything about it, and they took their opinions from the media, and it was no substitute for actually knowing the people. And I thought, well, it would be very interesting to actually know these people. And that was one of the attractions of being in the media business. When I got to the position of being associated with enough large and influential newspapers in major centers like London, I could meet anyone I wanted, and I did meet a great many people. I mean, it's the nature of news that it's what's interesting, and so you have a ringside seat on everything that's happening in all fields, you know, politics, business, culture, sport, whatever you want. And so I was always gratified to meet these people. And I've been struck by two things: how when you meet them, how much they look like you thought they looked like. It sounds absurd, but it's somehow surprising to see a tremendously famous person look exactly like he did in his photographs or something, you know.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, when you do meet them, it's somehow surprising, though only logical, that they are normal human beings. I mean, I met Charles de Gaulle once, and you know, he said hello very politely and so forth. And I mean, you'd say, well, of course he would, but it was still somehow surprising. You don't think of such prominent people ever having routine moments, but of course they do. You know, and in most respects, they're just like the rest of us.
There's a piece in the book that you'd written, an homage to Lyndon Johnson, and because of that, you got to meet him. Is that right?
That is right. In fact, I had I had met him just to shake hands with once before, but just that's all. And because of that piece, I did in fact meet him and have quite an extensive conversation with him. Yes.
Yeah. And this was at the ranch, I guess, right? And
that's right.
Yeah. And so, was his hair long at that point, and was he sort of
no?
No. Okay.
No. It was only when I met him was only a year and a half after he'd. And in fact, it was less than that. I'm sorry. It was about 8 months after he'd left office, and he looked as he did when he was president. The period you're referring to was in the last year before he died, several years later.
Yeah. So what's it like then to meet someone like him? Because he's a larger than life figure.
He was a very big man personally. You know,
physically,
he was a formidable man. You know, and he stood very close to you when he met you, and he sort of looked down right into your eyes, and you could smell his mouthwash and so on. He was quite the he was a very formidable man in all respects.
Yeah, and you also talk about other figures that you got to know as well, like Margaret Thatcher and Richard Nixon. When you get to know them as you do, does that color your view of their place in history? Are you able to separate who they are as to their public record?
Yes, I think so. I think so. I think it can. How should I put this? I think when you, in the case of the two you mentioned, Margaret Thatcher and Richard Nixon, I did get to know them fairly well. And Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister and afterwards, and Mr. Nixon as an ex-president. But they were so controversial, and they were so courteous and pleasant in person that I think it created an increased reservoir of sympathy for them. I don't mean condescending sympathy; I mean sort of empathy, more than sympathy. And on the other hand, some people I've met I did not find especially pleasant as individuals, but I always try and strain that out. I mean, in my previous book, My History of Canada, I gave my assessments of the prime ministers, all of them, including those who are still alive, and I have had serious differences with some of those and been very friendly with some others, but I tried to be fair to all of them and as upbeat as I could about all of them. But where you're writing for the record, if you will, either actually writing a history or even just an opinion piece that is going out into the public and is apt to remain there, any conscientious writer, certainly, I think, would be quite widespread as the practice, tries to separate personal experiences of the individual from what can best be case of Mr. Nixon, especially, he was so controversial, and his administration ended in such a terrible avalanche of obloquy. There was, and this was my chief motive in writing a biography of him. There was a need to unearth him, liberate him from this. Interment he had suffered over the Watergate affair, and examine his actual record, which was very successful, actually very distinguished.
So I guess you knew Nixon after the White House years.
Last 5 years of my life. Yeah. I knew him when. As he said himself, quoting Milton, his soul was serene, all passion spent. I think, from what I have read, that he was a much more agitated person in his active career. I didn't see much of that. He'd got all the fires tamped down and spoke very rationally and philosophically about things. Just to judge from some of the things that are in the famous tapes and so on, he clearly was in a rather overwrought state at times in his career. But when I knew him, he'd come to terms with everything.
In the book are a number of book reviews that you've done over the years, and you've always reviewed books throughout your career as a writer. How do you go about doing that? I mean, is how you review a book, say, different than how others might?
I don't know that I can do a comparison for you, Joe. To start with, I actually read the book, and not all reviewers do, and I do read it. I read every word of the book. And then I just give it my best try. And if you're reviewing a book by a friend of yours, it can sometimes be difficult because, in the first place, I always do my best for authors, unless it's just a terrible book or a person that I simply can't abide, in which case I wouldn't normally review the book, but unless it's an exceptional case like that, I know how much trouble it is to write a book and how hard people work at it. And I know how protective you can get about a book you've written. It's sort of like the attitude one has to his own child. It becomes quite offensive personally if someone criticizes it, and I respect that. And so I try to be fairly positive, but occasionally it does create a very difficult choice to be made between impartiality of judgment and the ties of loyalty and friendship. So you've just got to be careful in those ones. If I know the author well or the subject well, I always mention that. So I think that's a reasonable disclosure to make.
Yeah. And so that means you're a fast reader then, I'm assuming.
Actually not that fast, but quite retentive, I'd say. Medium speed only, medium to laborious, but once I've read it, I remember it well.
Now, do you have pets now?
Yes. Well, I don't myself, but in the house here, we have two dogs and two cats, but the manager of the house has the cats, and they're my wife's dogs, but I walk them each night. That's the division of work we have. We stay up relatively late, and I take them out around 1 a.m.
Yeah, because there is a piece in the book about dogs and cats, and what I chuckled at the end of it, you write, as you're revisiting the piece, at the reaction that people have towards columns like that as opposed to, say, world events.
Yes, and my wife warned me. She said, look, if you get to abortion, you'll get a heavy response. If you get anywhere near child pornography or abuse of children, anything like that, you get an even greater response. But the third rail is dogs or cats. If you get to them, and especially both of them in the same column, the mailbox won't be I mean, either literally the mailbox or the cyber mailbox won't be big enough to accommodate the traffic you'll get.
And so
it's true. It's a stupefying response. You must have encountered this yourself. You get into dogs and cats, and especially the competing merits of those two animals. Then, not to make a terrible pun, but the fur really flies.
Do the cats and the dogs that you have that are at your house, do they get along?
Yeah, perfectly well. Very, very well. There's never a problem. And it's hard to explain why, but I think it is that the dogs are almost like wolves, so they are somewhat feline themselves.
Hmm.
I mean, they're perfectly house trained, as cats are too, but they're not obedient. They do what they feel like, and the only way you can actually influence their conduct is by holding out the prospect of food. No matter how well fed they are, they don't seem to be hungry.
Yeah. There was a piece in the book on Victoria Day, and you write about what a big deal that was for you and how much you enjoyed that holiday as opposed to, say, other holidays. I mean,
well, you got fireworks.
Yeah.
I'm going back to when I was young, you know.
Yeah. So is Christmas, I mean, is that a big deal at your house now?
Not especially, because, you know, I have two sons and a daughter, and they're all adults, and my daughter lives overseas, and they're mine by virtue of my previous marriage. So the way it all works out is it's really just my wife and me. So it's a pleasant day, but not a great occasion. I had that as a younger person. My mother was from a large family, and we had a great many cousins, and we'd all get together. And I think I was sort of familied out a bit for Christmas in my earlier years. You know, rather the way I was cottaged out. We had a very nice summer cottage, but I'm not one of these people, like many friends of mine, who have gone all their lives to their cottages and carry on like that. After a while, I didn't particularly want to go to a cottage anymore. I don't mind going for a weekend or something, but we usually are in Europe in July, and where we live in Toronto is lovely in August. It's a sizable property, and with all the leaves on the trees, you can't see another building, and you might as well be out in the country. It's very nice.
Yeah, and the other thing that I enjoyed in the book were your thoughts on faith, and that remains, I guess, for you. That's an important part of your life, and you don't talk about it very much, but you do somewhat in this book, right?
Yeah, I'm of that school that I think is quite a numerous one that regards these as essentially personal matters, and I think, like most people, I'm not swaddling myself in majoritarian logic here, but I believe most people would agree with me that I find zealots tiresome. In general, I respect their attachment to whatever they are ardent about, unless it's completely psychotic or something. But I mean, obviously, one doesn't respect the zeal of a Nazi or something like that. But I respect people who have very strong faith or a very strong aversion to faith. But in general, I think that religion is like sex, so that people should do what works for them, be discreet about what they do, respect the views of others unless they're, as I say, completely aberrant, and just take it from there. But because at a couple of times there was some public comment on my religious views, I thought it was appropriate to put in a few references to it. And of course, there are legitimate controversies in the news about matters touching upon churches, and the issue of molestation of children by clergy and that kind of thing. I mean, these are serious subjects that are legitimate matters of public comment.
I mean, you're a Catholic, I'm a Catholic, and so I'm wondering, does this time of year, Christmas, does it have a, is your faith a little more, does it feel special for you a little bit more this time?
I take the birth of Christ seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, one does not have to believe implicitly that his biological sire was a spirit producing a virgin birth to accept that he was a divinely inspired individual and one whose birth, both by virtue of his own qualities and by virtue of the importance that he has had in history and in the culture of the world, justifies some degree of reverence for him.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, I would expect even a relatively intelligent atheist to have some respect for Christ.
Yeah.
When you're putting together a collection like Backward Glances, do you think about how you're perceived and what your legacy might be, say, especially in terms of the writing you've done?
No, I think legacy is an overdone word. I don't much think in terms of that. I think in terms of what I can aspire to do and in fact do. So I'm assessing, you know, my own. I'm sort of writing up my own report card in myself, but not lingering in my mind as a concern about what posterity will think of me if it thinks of me at all. But in putting together a collection, I you see, I'm too busy with other things to write a big book with 1,000 or 2,000 footnotes like I did in my Life of Roosevelt or History of Canada or the United States. But I don't want to just, you know, vanish from the shelves. So this was, frankly, a bit of a comparatively unchallenging way to sort of stay in the game of writing. And once I got into it, I did find it somewhat interesting to take subjects like, you know, Canadian affairs or American public policy or international affairs over a period of 40 years or more. I mean, the piece about President Johnson you mentioned was published in 1969, mm-hmm. 47 years ago, and was in the Congressional Record. And, I tried to make it, as I said, and you were kind enough to suggest this, as varied as I could. And as little repetitive as possible. Obviously, columnists like people in your line, the same general subjects come up again and again. So to some degree, we're always putting old wine in new bottles, and you've got to start the thing up again. And I did at the outset of this book ask a little indulgence from the readers for being repetitive, but I did my very best to get that out of there, so they weren't going, you know. General Patton's phrase, paying for the same real estate twice.
It's a great collection. Congratulations on it, and best of the season. Happy Christmas to you and your family.
Thank you so much, Joe. All the best to you, and all the best for the new year.
The book is called Backward Glances, People and Events from Inside and Out. It's published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Conrad Black joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.